Hello, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have Victoria on, talk about all the tax write-offs, the deductions, the, you know, we're going to pop some myths on all the Instagram and TikTok influencers on what you really can deduct, because Victoria actually worked for the IRS as an auditor for 22 years. So we're not, we're not talking about, you know, some guy that's just ranting about selling advice or whatever it is. We're getting right into it today. And Victoria, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. Like you said, I've been with the IRS for 22 years and just left in October.
Congratulations.
Well, congratulations on your next career moves. I have a burning question. Sorry, I got to get right into it. Next week, or I guess this week, whenever Valentine's Day is, I should probably know this, February 14th,
Saturday.
Delta Airlines loves its employees by giving its bonus on February 14th. And this year, Delta pilots are earning an estimated 8.9% on their eligible earnings, which is roughly about 4 weeks of extra pay, which is super cool. So I've got a question that always comes up. If I'm a Delta pilot making $500,000 a year and I get 8.9%, I'm going to get about $44,500 that lands in my paycheck. If you give a pilot a bag of money, they'll complain that it's too heavy, right? That's the joke, right? And so anyway, they're going to complain that they're going to see this massive tax amount come out. And Victoria, my understanding is that 37% of that bonus is going to get taxed. Can you explain why this happens?
So really why that happens is the IRS has a graduated pay withholding scale. And so based on that, they think, okay, if you made this amount every single pay period, then you would owe this much money at the end of the year. So if it just assumes that you're making this bonus amount every single pay period, and it's going to withhold at the top rate for that. So if your actual rate is less, then you will have refund at the end of the year. But if your tax rate is at the 37%, then you will end up owing that much money.
There it is.
That makes a lot of sense. And the other question I get a lot is like how this graduated tax rate works. And I know this is a very basic question, but I think a lot of people, you know, don't know this. Like, how does our tax system work? How does income tax work on a graduated scale? Can you kind of walk us through that?
So they have just kind of different levels where you'll have, okay, from, you know, this point to this point, you get 0% tax. And then beyond that, you know, and it gradually increases up to the 37%. And it also varies, you know, that number of what moves it from one to the next also varies based on your marital status, whether you're single or you're married or you're filing head of household. You know, those are the three qualifications of, you know, there's three different sets of tables for that. And so you will go through and you'll analyze, okay, based on my marital status, here's the cutoff and here's the little, you know, I go from one to the next, you know, and those numbers change based on, you know, marital status. So if you get divorced, you know, that's going to be a change.
Yeah. Yeah. Double pain. Yeah. And if you want to look at those tax brackets, it's very easy. You just type into Google 2026 tax brackets. You can see exactly where each one of those graduated steps is. So, you know, everybody thinks like, oh, if I make over X amount, my entire earnings are taxed at, you know, 35%. That's not the case. It's the, you know, the first bit is taxed at 10, and then another bit is taxed at 12, and then it goes up and up and up until the last dollars in the door are at those very high tax rates.
But the bottom line is that $44,500, that might not be taxed at that 37%. That might only be taxed at whatever your effective rate is for that money. So you might be getting a refund back, or you might actually be taxed on that full amount. It just depends on your personal situation. So don't be alarmed when you see that, but Taxman is going to take it out. Now, Tate, I know you're dying to jump in. We are talking about some exciting things today. We're not going to be talking about the income tax rates, but we're going to be talking about aircraft tax deductions.
Yeah, we're excited to have Victoria Boone on today. She's a seasoned tax consultant and federal tax authority with over 20 years of experience at the IRS, specifically with aircraft. And the IRS is looking into aircraft nowadays. So without further ado, let's get to the show. We've got a really interesting episode ahead of us.
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
My name's Gloria Boone. I'm a former IRS subject matter expert, and I was with the IRS for 22 years. The last 5 years, I was a subject matter expert, and I covered a lot of different areas, but one of the areas that I really focused in on was the deductibility of aircraft. So I did a lot of information on that. I was part of the campaign on aircraft. So that's kind of my background. Since then, I have left the IRS in October 1st, and I have joined my husband's company. So we're now co-owners in Boone.tax, no E. And I also started an education company. So we do continuing education for accountants that deal with tax matters or people that are interested in tax matters, whether it be an accountant or not, just to be able to understand what those are. So,
well, and this is why we wanted to have a conversation with you. We're delighted to have you on, by the way. Thank you so much for joining us. 22 years at the IRS, and now you are providing continuing education for enrolled agents and CPAs. So, I mean, you talk about direct from the horse's mouth. I mean, this is, you are the authority here.
Yeah.
So really excited to jump into this because we've had people on the show in the past that have talked about the deductibility of aircraft. We've talked about buying aircraft, putting it in a flight school lease back and all sorts of ways that you can write off a plane, which is very attractive. You know, we've all heard the story of, you know, Grant Cardone going out and buying a Gulfstream because he needed a tax write-off. So where do you want to start? I'd like to start with maybe like unpacking what is Section 179 and, you know, bonus depreciation, all that. And maybe we can build into the deductibility of heavy equipment and aircraft and so on and so forth. What are your thoughts there?
Sure. I mean, we can just start off with bonus depreciation because I think that's great. Most applicable. Yes, you can do 179D, but I think that given the, since the One Big Beautiful Bill Act came into play, there's 100% bonus depreciation on a lot of assets. So the majority of assets that you can think of that you would place into service in a business, other than like buildings and things like that, you are subject to availability of 100% bonus depreciation. And so that really is one of the biggest things with aircraft or any other kind of equipment and machinery, you know, after, if they're acquired and placed in service after January of 2025, you can write off the whole thing in the first year. Now, I will say that one thing that is required for aircraft, because they are listed property, is that they have to do a calculation every year that the asset is placed in service. And it's called a qualified business use. So the qualified business use has to be at least 50%. So the moment it drops to 50% or less, they don't get bonus depreciation.
Got it.
But in addition to that, you now have to recapture any depreciation you took in the prior year. So that really comes into play because people think, oh, look, I took this aircraft and I bought it and I deducted it. But then in year two, I didn't use it as much for the business. I used it more personally. And now all of a sudden I have this a whole bunch of income to recuperate that I have to report and I didn't do anything. You know, like it's a shock to them, a lot of people when they do that. So bonus depreciation is great. It's an immediate write-off. If done properly, it's definitely a very good and useful thing to have, but just do know that there is some depreciation recapture that might come into play going in the future if that falls below 50% business use.
So I'm curious, let's talk about real estate for a second, because our audience is very familiar with real estate depreciation and cost segregation studies and bonus depreciation. If you were to buy, let's say, a short-term rental, we've talked about this strategy on the show, you 100% bonus it, you run it as a short-term rental for a couple of years, and you decided to move into it. Does that same rule apply?
It's not the same rule apply.
Right.
There might be some depreciation recapture when you sell it, but that does not come into play with the short-term rentals because it's not listed property.
Got
listed
it.
Property is specifically defined in IRC 280F. And so that's what defines listed property. So
And what is listed property? Is that like equipment, essentially?
It's anything used to transport people or goods. So that would be aircraft. That would be vehicles, cars, trucks, semis, buses. If you're transporting people or goods, that's what goes into 280F. Now, there are some exceptions, so I'm not going to go into all of those little details. But, you know, IRC 280F is what defines what listed property is. And it's, I will say that with technology that's coming out, drones are often put right into that same category.
Got it.
And they do have that bonus depreciation recapture as part of that.
Okay. Interesting. And this is why, if you're running a business, you need to be working with an astute CPA that knows all these ins and outs, right? Yeah. So, okay, well, that's good news. So on real estate, you know, you could convert something into a primary residence after a few years. You don't have to pay back that recapture until, of course, you sell it, which is the way that I had previously understood it. So I wanted to make sure that was still tracking. So this kind of blows up the idea that you could buy an airplane, put it into service in, let's say, a flight school, and then after a couple of years, just pull it out and use it 100% for personal use. And you wouldn't have to pay any recapture tax until the day you sold it. That's actually not the case. So you'd have to pay all the recapture on that. And essentially, for anybody that maybe is just tuning in and they don't know what recapture tax is, do you want to break down that concept?
So depreciation recapture in terms of listed property. So it works a little bit differently for other assets because it's usually when it's sold is when you have depreciation recapture. But for listed property, the depreciation recapture is you have to take into income the difference between whatever depreciation was taken, bonus depreciation, 179, whatever was taken, and what straight line would have been. So right. That portion has to be picked up in income. So a lot of times by the time the asset is closer to the end of its class, you know, useful life, then that doesn't really matter much, right?
Oh, so it's only the difference between what straight line would be, which on an aircraft is what, 7 years?
Yes.
So, you know, if you buy $1 million airplane, let's say $7 million airplane, that'll make the math really easy, right? You could straight line depreciate it for 7 years until it on paper would be worth zero. So if you kept it in a flight school, let's say for 7 years, you wouldn't have to recapture anything. Am I right there?
Right. It just has to do with, now, I mean, whether you can deduct it or not, you know, that's a whole nother story, but
right.
Depreciation recapture is what gets a lot of people because they don't understand. They just think, okay, I got the depreciation and that's done. And that is the case as long as you continue to meet the qualified business use rules and that you're still doing that at, you know, more than 50%. So.
Understood. Okay. So if someone, you know, wants to use this tax strategy, if they're an airline pilot out there and you're like, hey, I really wanted to buy an airplane this year and I wanted to be able to take the write-off, let's say you were going to finance it by 50%, you know, that could be a really attractive write-off. If you're buying a $1 million airplane, you're only putting down 500,000 or even less, you're getting a 2-to-1 tax write-off. How does someone do this legally? And then I want to get into the documentation of what would be required so that if they were looked at by the IRS, that it would just be a non-issue.
Sure. So as far as, you know, legally doing it, you know, as long as you place it in service and you use it for the business, you can legally write it off. If you want to do bonus depreciation, just make sure that it's at least 50% business. And that business percentage always stays above 50%. And you will be through the whole asset life, and you won't have to worry about depreciation recapture or anything like that.
Right.
And so that is something that's very beneficial. Like you said, you can write it all off. You know, you have a huge write-off in 1 year and there's not a whole lot of, you know, income outlay there. Now, as far as documentation, the IRS has got really, really strict documentation requirements. The code section is IRC 274 paren little d. And that goes into a lot of details on the strictness of it. It has to be the time, the place, the business relationship. And that really is what catches a lot of people, is that there's not a business relationship or there's not a business purpose. And each of these items has to be substantiated on a per leg flight leg. Yeah, sorry, right. I'm sorry about that. So each has to be done on a per flight leg per person basis. So if you go from point A to point B with three people, you need to know each person, what's their business purpose, and you know what is their relationship to that company. And that can be documented with agendas, right? I went to go visit this customer. You know, here is my agenda. Here's emails. Here's meeting agendas, contracts that were signed, other kind of business purpose, you know, documents that come up behind that and support, not just, hey, look, I said it was this person, you know, so you have to document the people's names. What's their relationship to the company? And in addition to that, you know, what's the purpose of that specific trip?
Right. And if some of the occupants of the aircraft aren't, you know, involved in the business, let's say, you know, a couple of people are bringing their spouses because they're going to enjoy some time off at the destination, that would also affect the percentage business use of the trip, right?
Yeah. So that would go into the qualified business use of that trip. So if there's five people, three are business, two are personal, then that's how that gets allocated out, right? Each person gets allocated as either business or personal, and that gets out. And that's how that's allocated. Now, what is interesting, and you also want to kind of make sure that you understand that's different for aircraft than it is for other listed property, is deadhead flights, right? You go and you pick someone up and you drop them off, and then you have to fly the plane back with no one in it. Well, when you fly them back, that is called a deadhead flight, and the deadhead flights are then allocated the same way as the flight that you delivered the people in, for example. So it's associated with that. So if that one was all personal, then the deadhead flight is all personal back. If the flight that it's associated with is, you know, three people business, one personal, then that's exactly what the deadhead flights, that's how they're treated as well.
Good to know. Let's take a little tangent and talk about some crazy stories. I don't know if you mind sharing, but can you give us an example of one of the most like egregious stories that I mean, I imagine in 22 years of the IRS, you've seen some pretty crazy stuff.
Do you want stories about aircraft in particular or stories about audits?
Both. Maybe we, whatever you want. What do you got?
So I guess for the aircraft, a lot of times it's people try to say that it's a business purpose. I need to go visit this office or this location for this reason. And you start, you know, really digging into, okay, well, what's the office that you are going to? Where are the emails? Where's this? And you find out that they were just going to visit their child that's in college, and they are going to visit the bowl games, you know, high school or college bowl games, that's usually a big thing that they'll put in there as deductible. As far as people, I've seen chefs, nannies, the dogs don't count. They're not people, so they don't count for qualified business use. They can fly on the jet and it's okay. So there's lots of interesting things that that I've seen as far as aircraft, and it goes into, okay, I trust but verify. What is kind of what the auditors do, you know, like, I trust that you're telling me the truth, but I'm going to verify and look into it. And so sometimes when you look into it, you get quite the interesting information on that when it comes back and you're like, oh,
right.
Okay. Well, you say that this person is an employee of your company, but she's always only flies with the CFO. And she only, she doesn't appear to be on any of the agendas, doesn't appear to do any of that stuff. So,
all right. What about just in general, what's the craziest thing you ever saw while you were at the IRS?
Well, I will say that one of the craziest things that I saw is we are required to take a tour of the business. As a field examiner, we're required to take tours. And I saw some really amazing things, you know, manufacturing wise and just to see those things. But sometimes you're also called out to someone's kitchen table. And you're doing audits on someone's kitchen table, and that's completely fine. But one of the craziest incidents that I remember is that I went out to a logger Like, so they would cut the logs down and transport them. And
yeah.
He had already shut his business down. So I was going out rural North Carolina, middle of nowhere, no cell service, to go sit down at his kitchen table and help him figure out what was going on with his return. And when I got there, first of all, I got lost getting there. I finally get there. I pull in and the guy is literally covered in blood. And there is like dogs that are going crazy. And there's a kid that's running off and crying. And I'm going, what is going on? Like, this is completely crazy. Apparently he had just broken up a dog fight. And one of his dogs and another dog had been fighting, and it was his daughter's dog. So she's running off after the dog. He's got dog blood all over him. And so he was quite upset about everything that occurred. And I'm like, it's okay. Just take some time, go wash up, and, you know, we will deal with this later. Like, are you okay? Are you injured? No. He was.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably one of the most interesting days.
Did he end up being like a nice guy? And you...
Yeah, he was a very sweet guy, and you know, he was just having
a scary scene to show up to.
Yeah, but it was just, you know, walking in, you're going, what is going on? Because here's all this dogs barking, and the guy's got blood on him, and you're going, are you okay? Am I okay to like safe to even get out of my car? Like, what? Going on. So I think that's probably one of the craziest stories that I had as an auditor.
So what I know that pilots are often terrified of audits, and I'd love to sort of just break down the mystery around them. So first of all, like what triggers an audit? What are some things that stand out in your mind that you know that's going to really raise some red flags?
So I don't think there's any one particular thing that triggers an audit. They have, now I will say, aircraft is going to trigger an audit right now. And that's because the IRS has a campaign focused in specifically on aircraft. So
Victoria, are you saying that if you were to buy an aircraft in 2026, like you're pretty much guaranteed to get audited?
I won't say that you're guaranteed to be audited, but you are at a higher likelihood of being audited just because the IRS does have a campaign. They are auditing returns. There's less auditors. So, you know, they're going to focus in on the items that they've identified as areas of interest that they think that there's a tax gap in. And they have specifically identified aircraft. That campaign isn't going anywhere because aircraft industry is booming. I mean, I'm in Greensboro, North Carolina. We got Boom Supersonic starting up. We got Honda Jet.
Right.
We got like all these different business jets that are right here, you know, in Greensboro. And they just keep expanding the airport and flying over my house.
Victoria, if you wouldn't mind, like, who are we talking about here? You said they're dying to audit people that buy aircraft. Are you talking about personal use, business use, corporate flight departments? Can you kind of maybe truncate that into...
Yeah, like personal use, they don't care. I mean, you can go buy your personal aircraft and do whatever you want with it. You know, the IRS doesn't care about that. It's really, you know, any kind of business use of the jet or any kind of plane, actually, it doesn't really matter. But that's really focus is there.
And what are they looking for? You know, usually an audit is kind of a smoking gun for something, right? So what is the thing that they're trying to find that you're doing incorrectly when they go sniffing?
Usually it's documentation. It usually has to do with not documenting the people that are in the aircraft, not documenting the business purpose, not documenting the business use, having a lot of personal use. You know, we had talked a little bit earlier about depreciation recapture or things like that that come into play when you don't have more than 50% business use. So that's really what I'm focusing in on.
Okay, so it's documenting. So that's me flying from point A to point B and saying, I flew to a meeting to meet with this so-and-so person or some kind of logbook. Is that kind of, okay, so you're shaking your head, yes.
You have to have that logbook, but in addition to that, you have to have, if you're going to meet with someone, there's going to be an email, there's an agenda, there's something else to back that up.
That makes, so there's even more kind of a surface layer down than just logging the flight. It's well, you know, is the IRS entitled to emails, to kind of an agenda items of, you know, business types of purpose? Or is that, you know, is that an invasion of privacy? I guess, you know, it's kind of seems to me like, yeah.
That's the documentation requirements that are under IRC 274 paren D, is what goes into substantiating anything used for listed property, which is 280F. You know, that's aircraft is listed property. So is your car, you know, so anything used for transportation. So, you know, when you go into substantiation requirements, there's a lot of court cases that are out there that say, if you don't substantiate it, you don't get the expense for it. So if you want the depreciation expense, you have to substantiate it. In order to substantiate it, then you're going to need to provide agendas, you know, or calendars or emails or something showing that there's some business purpose there.
When they come for the airplane audit, are you opening sort of a tax door to other things in your tax return? Or do they kind of just stay on the airplane and don't venture in to other things? Or are they now wandering around your entire tax return and saying, what else is this person?
That's really kind of depends. Yeah. You know, what they do is they are required to, if their return is selected for audit for aircraft campaign, they're required to look at the aircraft. They're required to look at all the things related to the aircraft. But they also have a responsibility to look at large, unusual, and questionable items. That's their big, those are the key phrases, large, unusual, and questionable. So if they have any other items that are on the return that are large, unusual, or questionable, they might be added to the audit.
Makes sense.
But if they don't, if that's the only large item, and usually when you have an aircraft, depreciation is going to be your large item. So,
right,
you know, that's what will kind of flag things, that there's an aircraft. They have software that actually goes through and looks for items on the return, you know, expenses related to aircraft and, you know, in the other deductions and things like that, that that'll let them know that there is an aircraft. They even go through the 10Ks and all that kind of stuff and wow, pull out who has aircraft with that.
So, you know, the way we actually got in touch with you, just for full transparency for the audience, is actually you commented on one of Nathan Sosa's posts on LinkedIn. And, you know, Nathan had taken a screenshot of a tax filing, and there's a question on the tax filing 24C that says, do you own, lease, or charter an aircraft? Check all that apply. And so that's kind of the, when was that line item added to this tax form?
It was added recently. I'm not sure exactly how recently, but that is a result of the aircraft campaign, because the campaign will do multiple things. They'll go and they'll provide additional information. They'll provide updates to maybe clarification to instructions, things like that. But, and they will, right, also do audits. So a campaign isn't always just, I'm going to audit you.
Just a request for more information.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. Getting back to the airline pilot, they want to buy an airplane this year, and they do want the deduction. So it has to be for business use. How does someone successfully use it for business? And usually for pilots, they're not going to be, you know, flying from point A to point B to meet business partners. It's more going to be either leasing it back to a flight school or putting it into some sort of a lease back pool. So maybe a group of people can lease the aircraft for either personal or business use. How can they successfully structure this so that it's legitimate? And then how do they document that? Maybe we talk about the flight school first, because that's kind of we can put up a clean line between, you know, giving it to a flight school that it's like literally in the flight school program, and it's, say, a little Cessna that's flying around, versus maybe a more complex aircraft that somebody's putting in a lease pool.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the aircraft, it's just having some kind of agreement. I mean, there's definitely, I've seen a lot of different agreements. There's not one specific one that's better than others. Throughout my years auditing aircraft, there has been a plethora of different arrangements that are made. Just know that there's a business purpose. You know, it'll document what the business purpose is and showing that it's actually been used, making sure that you have captured all of the flights, because the IRS does have access to the FAA data. So they're going to go to your flight logs and they're going to compare it to the FAA data and say, okay, let's make sure that all of the flight numbers are there and all of that is accounted for.
Got it.
In taking a step back, you said that, you know, buying an aircraft is for business purposes is going to subject you to audit. Do you think there's less likelihood of an audit when it's a flight school airplane that's $50,000 for a, you know, an old 172 you're putting in the fleet, or is the risk higher if it's a, you know, $5 million business jet?
I'm sure the it's going to definitely, you know, be a higher risk at the, because it's a larger just dollar number. You know, having the smaller numbers isn't going to necessarily raise as much of a red flag as the larger numbers. You know, $5 million in 1 year, you know, that'll get someone's attention. Yeah. And say, hey, totally. Hang on a second. Especially when there wasn't, when the depreciation jumps $5 million in 1 year, you're like, wait, what just happened here? You know, and that's one thing that I really enjoyed at the IRS is seeing how a tax return actually takes life, right? You know, there's, it might be just a document to some people, but when you look at it, you're going, okay, wait, this number went up by 5 million. What happened? Let's look into it. Why does this, let's put eyes on it. Like, why did this happen? And then you're like, oh, okay, well, there's a new aircraft. Well, let's look at the aircraft. Let's get the purchase documents. It's, you know, and then you're like, oh, okay, well, this makes sense. But, you know, that's one of those large, unusual or questionable items, you know, given that. Now, also, if you have a $50,000 plane and you're at a $10 million in income, that, you know, that, you know, that $50,000 plane isn't going to be as big of a deal. So everything is kind of perspective there.
What if someone wants to, I selfishly, you know, someday I would love to have a, you know, nice fast airplane, but I probably won't use it enough to make sense to just own it on my own. So my idea would be, hey, start an LLC, buy the airplane, the business owns it. And then when I want to use it, whether for business purposes or for personal purposes, I would rent it from the business. So, you know, and if I'm renting it for personal use, I would just use my personal credit card. And that would be after tax money that I'm using to rent the aircraft. And if I'm using it for business purposes, I would put it on my business credit card. But the business itself, that would be, you know, income for the business. And is that an appropriate structure? And of course, there would be other people who would have access to it as well and be able to rent it for the same price.
Right. So, you know, as long as you want to make sure it's fair rental value that you're using, fair lease value or whatever, you're using the same amounts. And so that's one thing to make sure, because a lot of times when those structures are set up, they're like, okay, well, I can use it at a reduced rate, right, versus other people. And then that gets into issues with, you know, is this really, you know, an arm's length transaction? But if it's an arm's length transaction, you know, the deductibility of the aircraft is now in this LLC, right? It's, you know, that is its own little tax entity there. So it's not subject to whether you use it for business or personal, right? That's now on you when you're paying for it.
Well, that might be a good structure then. Can I ask kind of a follow on to what Ryan was saying? If it's in an LLC, does that sort of arm's length the audit, or does an audit jump from an entity which owns the aircraft over into your personal?
It can jump all over the place depending
right,
on.
Right. That's good to know. I mean,
for the most part, it'll stay with the entity that is the ownership. But depending on how that LLC is set up, you know, it could be a disregarded entity. It could be an S corp, a partnership. You know, depending on how that's set up, if there's any implications between that entity and you personally, then it could be expanded to you personally. And that's one of the requirements that the auditors have, is that they make sure that if it's a partnership, they make sure that the partners filed their returns and that they reported the income.
Right.
So they're required to do those filing checks. If it's a corporation, they make sure that the highly compensated individuals file their tax returns. You know, if it's an S corp, they make sure that the K-1s are reported. So there is that requirement.
Yeah.
You know, and most of the time it stays just with that, you know, like check the box, but, you know.
Excellent.
So what's the so what? So I jump on my G200 that I don't have, by the way, and I go fly to my kid's birthday party in Disney World. And what's the so what? Am I going to unwind all my depreciation
not for that one specific trip, unless that's the only trip you make on that plane that year. And that would be
But I mean, just like kind of what's the downside to, or maybe it was a business trip, but I'm missing my agenda. I didn't take copious notes. I didn't make a contemporaneous, you know, logbook. I didn't do the things I'm supposed to do. So is it just, hey, you've got to unwind the fuel and you can't write that off? Or is it really damaging beyond that?
In and of itself, that one event is not that big of a deal. It's when you combine those little events up and it becomes, so there are two different tests that are done on aircraft. The first one is qualified business use. So if that drops below 50%, then you now can't take bonus depreciation. So you have straight line depreciation, which is less, and you might have depreciation recapture and pick that up in income. And then the second one is you take not only the depreciation, but the fuel, the hangar fees, the maintenance, all of those, you know, all of those expenses related to that asset, and you put it in and you calculate how much of that can you deduct. So, you know, if you have just one little flight, okay, well, you have one little item, it doesn't mark it down below 100%, you know, below the 50%, you still get your bonus depreciation. You just get a little bit less, you know, deduction for business use part of it.
Exactly.
And so, just to be clear, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. Let's say you use an aircraft 60% for business, 40% for personal in the year that you purchase it. Let's say you purchase it in 2026. We've got 100% bonus depreciation. It's $1 million airplane. And you're like, cool, I get $1 million tax write-off. Well, you would just back that off. You would get a $600,000 because it would be 60-40.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, got it. And if bonus depreciation didn't exist and it's a 7-year lifespan, then you'd get 60% of that 1/7 write off every year.
You know, the depreciation for aircraft is either 5 or 7 year, depending on, you know, what it's being used for. So,
right.
You know, sometimes it's 5 years, 7 year part.
And I think I'm going to use it half the time for business. So can I use a real world example? So I'm going to buy in for probably, let's say the airplane's worth $300,000 and half the time I'm going to travel. So you're saying I can take $150,000 and bonus it in the year that I buy it?
You can, as long as it's over, it's 51% business.
Sure.
So if you get 51% of the bonus depreciation.
So if it goes to 49% business use, you get none.
Right. You get straight line instead of bonus.
Okay. Okay. Got it. So the 50% or over is only for bonus. So you still get the straight line depreciation on the 40% business use or whatever it is. If it falls below that 50, you're just ineligible for bonus depreciation.
Right. It has to be above 50 in order to get bonus depreciation. And then
that's a big deal.
It is.
I was thinking like, yeah, I'm going to buy this plane and, you know, I fly to go see properties all the time in the plane. I fly to see clients. I fly to see properties, but I am fully admitting that I'm going to go camping in the plane too with my family.
Right.
Right. So it's not just going to be business. And I acknowledge that. I just thought, I got to be honest, I thought it was an all or nothing election. I thought it was, you know, there was no gray area. Then only the flights I took, you know, on the trips to see properties could be deducting like maybe gas expenses or something like that. How does that apply to my hangar expense and my maintenance? Is it the same kind of thing?
You just take the business use part of it and that multiply that by all of your expenses. And that's what you get to take. And the rest, the personal use is what gets disallowed.
That's amazing.
Now, I will say that you were traveling to see properties. And so there are special rules when it comes to qualified business use, whether it gets in a little bit tricky when you're visiting properties, because there's a differentiation between ordinary necessary IRC 162 deductibility versus IRC 212, you know, investing in properties. So, but IRC 212 activities don't count for qualified business use. But if you're in the business of investing in properties, that's different. You see what I'm saying? Like if you're just passively going out to invest in properties.
This is really good. Let's get into this.
Yeah, this is really exciting, by the way.
This is really good because, because what we're differentiating here is, you know, the airline pilot that owns a Cessna or Bonanza and is going out to look at, you know, a rental property that they're going to buy versus Ryan, who owns a self-storage company that invests in self-storage facilities. So how are the rules applied differently in those two sections? Like, because it sounds to me like, Ryan, it is ordinary and necessary for you
100%
under Spartan to go and, you know, view the tour of this facility that you're going to raise, you know, private capital to buy. And that is the business versus the individual who's just going out to, you know, taking a couple hour flight to look at a property that they might, you know, put into their personal rental portfolio.
Right. So an example like Ryan's, where that is his activity, right? Like that is his business, that would be considered qualified business use to go out to that property and tour it and look at it and things like that. Whereas a private pilot is going through and they're going and they want to look at some rental property. Well, that is now passive income to them. That's IRC 212 income. And because it's IRC 212 income, it doesn't count for qualified business use. They have to use it in their business. So that is not part of the business, a core business. So therefore that it doesn't count for qualified business use. Now they can still deduct it. So there's the difference between qualified business use percentages and business percentages, right? So they can still deduct it. It just doesn't count for qualified business use.
What's the difference?
The difference is the qualified business use is when you calculate, can you take bonus depreciation or not?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Versus now we take whatever we calculated for your depreciation. We add up all the hangar fees. We add the maintenance. We add the fuel. We add pilot expenses. We add all that together and we allocate out what is business versus personal. So
got it.
The two calculations are very similar, but this is one example where it's different, where it can be business flights, but it's not qualified business use.
Got it. So Ryan's flight to go look at a self-storage facility, that flight counts towards that 51% business use, which qualifies him for bonus depreciation. Whereas the individual who's just flying out to look at the rental property, sure, they get to deduct that flight, the fuel, whatever, as long as they have a business entity, I suppose. I mean, I guess you could be a sole proprietor and just keep books, but it would not qualify them. It wouldn't count towards that 51% business use to get the bonus depreciation on the airplane. So with that being said, let's take this example of an airline pilot. You're buying an airplane. You want to use it for business use. Maybe it's a Bonanza and it doesn't really fit into a flight school. You don't want to, you don't want flight students flying a Bonanza around. It's a little bit too complicated of an airplane. How could that individual legitimize ordinary and necessary business use for that aircraft? What sort of things would they need to do? What sort of a side hustle would they need? Or how do they put it into a lease pool? I'm trying to give our audience ideas of, you know, how they can write off an airplane legitimately.
I mean, it's what are you using that aircraft for? Is it for sightseeing flights? Is it for, you know, flying others around? Is it chartered out to other people? You know, things like that is what would be, you know, like now it's in this business, you know, or it's being part of like Ryan's business, right? You know, my business is to set up self-storage facilities. If I'm going to do that, I need to visit properties. That's part of what I do is I have to visit properties. I'm going to use an airplane to go do it because I can't. There's nothing the IRS can't say, you know, you can't do that, you know.
Get back to my example. So I'm buying this plane that is going to be used, let's just say in this conversation, more than 51% of the time for business to go inspect properties, have business meetings, whatever it might be. Clearly, I qualify. I'm not holding you to that, Victoria. But, you know, in the example you gave, I would qualify for that necessary business use of the airplane. However, the 49% that I'm using it for personal has sort of made me want to buy this airplane with my own personal funds. Does my plane have to be owned by my business to qualify, or does it not matter? As an example, you know, we have a corporation that owns all these facilities, and so I'm an owner in that organization with a business partner. and the business partner is not flying the airplane for fun. So I want to go buy the plane and have fun, less than half the time and do for business more than half the time. Does my business Spartan have to buy the plane, or can I buy it personally and benefit from that, knowing that the plane is used sometimes for business? How does that kind of play, or does it matter?
Well, the person that owns the aircraft is the one that gets the deduction for depreciation. So that's where it matters, because, and that's where you can play around with the deductibility, right? Like, if I want the depreciation on the entity that owns the storage units, then that's where I put the plane. If I want the plane and I have a business that I'm going to use it for that business, but I'm also maybe using it for another business, or other things, then maybe I put it in a different entity. So I guess, the depreciation follows wherever the asset is owned.
Gotcha.
Makes sense. I want to switch gears a little bit off aircraft. There's been a lot of chatter on social media about equipment leasing, and I'd love to get your two cents on this. I've heard a number of pilots come up to me and say, oh yeah, I got this great thing that's going to get me this huge tax write-off. And I put $100,000 into this business, and they buy heavy equipment with it. And I get to 100% bonus depreciate it. I get to write it off against my W-2. And I go, it doesn't sound like you're materially participating. Do you have any comment on that?
I would look at the passive activity loss rules and material participation. Those things would be things that I would question in that scenario, because anytime you're writing anything off against your W-2 income, you have to look at the passive activity loss rules and material participation rules. I agree completely with that. Yes, the entity may be allowed to have the bonus depreciation, and they did that properly, and that passes through to you. But then there are other passive activity loss rules that do come into play, and there's limitations as far as basis and things like that that also come into play.
Let's apply this back to the airplanes, right? Because this is actually super important for the airline pilot that's thinking about buying that Cessna and putting in the lease pool of a flight school. Now we get into, okay, can they take that? Let's say it's a $50,000 airplane. It's 100% business use, right? Let's say they're not even flying it. It just goes into the flight school, and these flight students are flying it around, learning how to fly in it. And it's a business, right? There's maintenance expenses, but they're getting the income on the rentals. Is that active or passive? Can they write that off against their W-2 or not? And how can they bridge that gap? How can they get active enough in that business that it would be an active write-off?
I don't know what the rules are off the top of my head on like what the active participation rules, but I think it has to do with so many hours. So documenting the hours that you spend, documenting if there's anyone else that provides more participation than you do, mm-hmm. And that's really what it gets into. I don't remember exactly what the exact numbers are, but it gets into, documenting every time that you go and do something for that business, documenting that I did it, because that's where calendars come into play, right? I mean, you don't have to necessarily have a log that you keep somewhere specific, but if you have a calendar that tracks that, that's important.
The important takeaway here, guys that are listening, gals that are listening, it does matter how you do it, right? So don't just take somebody's word for it.
Yes.
That, you can just throw a plane in a flight school and take all that depreciation against your active income. Like, you have to set yourself up in a way where you're doing it correctly. And Victoria's
absolutely,
is acknowledging there are rules around it. There are probably memos or summaries that the IRS or case law or something that's happened to somebody. You're not the first one to think of this. So get the right counsel to make sure that you're doing the right activity to actually justify that loss, and don't find yourself in an audit going, oh, I didn't know, or I thought this guy told me, or I heard this on a podcast, right? No, like, have the right counsel in your corner to make sure that you're actually following the rules and you're doing it right, so you can actually get this write-off in the correct way.
And the IRS is looking, that's one of the things that they're really looking at, is all of this advice that's being put out on social media and TikTok and things like that. And that's incorrect advice. I mean, that's one of the other areas that they're really focusing in on, is, okay, there's a lot of incorrect advice going around. We're going to target that, and we're going to make sure that that's not going to continue going forward. So
that's good.
You know, that is an area that they will look at.
And this is why we try to go straight to the source, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. It's not Ryan and I up here, you know, doing TikTok videos about what you can write off. It's like, this is why we have a 22-year veteran from the IRS on the podcast. So
yeah, I love it.
Victoria, any parting wisdom before we kind of wrap things up? Would love to let people know how they can get in touch with you and maybe connect with you as well.
Yeah. So, I actually started an education company, Boone Tax Educators. You can find us at boontaxeducators.com. And we offer continuing education in a lot of different areas, one of which will have a cost segregation study class that's going on Wednesday. And we also have other classes that will come up like kind of exchanges, because that was one of the areas that I was a subject matter expert in. I will also be doing one on aircraft later this summer. So, you know, if you want to come check us out, feel free to do that. Even if you don't want the credentials, you know, you don't need any, you know, continuing education certificates. It's a lot of great information from former IRS people. And also I do some consulting. I'm and able to do that. Boone.tax, just no E on Boone. Usually people constantly think that there's an E on Boone, but there's not. So, you know, you can contact me there. So if you have questions, I don't know if you guys have more questions about like kind of exchanges or cost segregation or things like that, or if you wanted to schedule another one.
Yeah, we want to be respectful of your time. I mean, we've been, but I would love to do one on like kind exchanges. We haven't talked about 1031s much on this show. So that would be wonderful.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back because, you know, we wanted to keep this kind of focused on the aircraft side of it.
Yep.
And, but yeah, I think we should just schedule. I mean, if you're free to schedule, we got a link that we can do that. So it'd be great.
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. Cause that was one of the areas that before I left, just a little teaser here is that the first time in probably, I don't even know how long that the IRS publications were updated for like kind of exchanges. So the instructions, the form, and the publications were all updated right before I left. That was one of the big projects that I worked on. So there's a lot more clarity in the instructions and the forms and the publications than there has ever been. So that was one of the big projects I just completed right before I left. So
amazing.
That's great.
Rapid fire question. Is there any chance that the IRS moves off of faxes in the next decade?
I'm not sure. I mean, they are moving more and more to the document upload tool.
Oh,
I will say that is, I actually have free classes on dealing with the IRS. If people are interested, I offer a free class once a month on just dealing with the IRS. And it goes over a lot of the online tools that are available. So there's an individual online account that you can look and you can access a lot of your personal information and look that up. There's a business tool account. There's a tax professional account. There's energy credit accounts. So I do have a class that's all about that. And one of the things that we do discuss is the document upload tool. And, you know, technically the IRS doesn't use faxes. There's not a fax machine at the IRS anywhere. It's all e-faxes. It all goes directly to, if an IRS person gives you a fax number, it's just emailed. It just goes through the email system and goes straight to their email inbox. So
yeah, it makes sense.
That's interesting to know. Okay. Got it. The more you know. Well, thank you, Victoria. This has been wonderful. We'll link to those in the show notes. I might come and take one of your classes. That sounds fascinating. And we'll have you back. Absolutely.
All right. Sounds good.